This is Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Right, hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week.
The album you will be reviewing this week is My Aim Is True by Elvis Costello.
Oh, that's pretty good.
So here's a description of the album. It says, My Aim Is True is the 1977 debut album by Elvis Costello, marking the arrival of one of rock's sharpest songwriters. Blending elements of punk, new wave, and pub rock, the album delivers a raw yet sophisticated sound filled with biting lyrics and infectious melodies. Backed by the American band Clover before forming his own group, The Attractions, Costello crafts anthems of love, anger, and rebellion with tracks like Allison, Watching the Detectives, and Less Than Zero. With its nervy energy and literate songwriting, My Aim Is True set the stage for Costello's prolific and influential career. The album was released on 22nd of July, 1977. The genres are new wave, pub rock, punk rock, and power pop. Labels are Stiff Records and Columbia Records, and it was produced by Nick Lowe.
All right. I didn't know Nick Lowe produced it. That's cool.
And so if you're listening along, which we encourage you to do, what we do is we take the album at the halfway point, and album is split pretty evenly. There's 12 songs on the album, so it's split between side one and side two, six and six. So what we do is we'll start the first song, which is Welcome to the Working Week, and side two ends with Sneaky Feelings. So and we've linked the album in the show notes to both Spotify and Apple Music, so you can get it on your preferred streaming service. So without further ado, here is the first song on the album, Welcome to the Working Week. So here we go. All right, and ending side one with Sneaky Feelings. This album is a lot of fun so far. It's a great album. A lot of short, punchy, upbeat songs. This is my favorite period of Elvis Costello, his sort of early first maybe two or three albums. When he was more in that punk new wave sort of mode.
Yeah. No, I agree that this is definitely, I love this period of Elvis Costello's, career as well. But, he's got some good later stuff too. Like, I still think, like, I always thought that album Spike was heavily underrated.
Spike is a great album. Yeah. This is just like, to me, this is like just pure rock and roll. It's stripped down. There's not a lot of, it's just like, it's meat and potatoes. The songs are, I don't think there's a song that's over 4 minutes on here, and it's just it's a throwback to like what 50s rock and roll. It's funny, it's like last week we did Dark Side of the Moon, and that was like when progressive rock was sort of fresh and new, and by this time, by 77,
it wasn't
and doing something like this, it is sort of a response to that, you know, it's sort of the pendulum swinging back and forth, I guess. And yeah, I mean, he's just a singer, like he's really just a singer-songwriter who there's sort of like Nick Lowe produced this album, but I always saw like Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe, and Joe Jackson, sort of those three guys are very similar to each other. Yeah, and this was one of the albums that was in my dad's tape collection when he was sort of introducing me to, so I am quite familiar with this album. But yeah, I've always loved it. So
yeah, so far is really good songs on it. I think I've got this one on record somewhere. So welcome to the working week. It's really short. So
it's very short. Yeah, it's a minute and 23 seconds. So it's a very short song. Yeah, no, that's the thing about his early period is the songs are not, they don't extend at all. They're very, and I don't know, like, it's funny. I think we've talked about it before that the late 70s punk and new wave music movement, whatever you want to call it, it was happening in New York, but it's almost like parallel happening in the UK.
Yes, simultaneously happening in London. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's hard to say. It's just like who really started it, but there was like, you know, the glam sort of led to it, and there was like proto punk even before that. With like Iggy and the Stooges and the MC5 and stuff like that, who sort of laid like groundwork for a lot of like punk music coming along, and that was when, you know, prog was really big. You know, after prog gets a little bloated after a while, you need something to sort of cleanse the palate, and you need something that sounds a little bit more immediate.
Yeah, that is a good point. You sort of, I guess, yeah, the prog stuff was sort of born out of the psychedelic stuff.
Well, proto-punk sort of was too.
Proto-punk was too. But yeah, it's funny. It's like every so often, every couple of years, it seemed like there was something that was the complete opposite of what was popular a few years before. And I think you sort of need that shakeup every once in a while to keep things interesting. I don't see that happening now. And I think it's just because of the way music is now, it's so fragmented and so isolated. And there's all these
different
pockets. It's the industry and the internet, the way it is. But yeah, I think, I think Elvis Costello was just writing rock and roll songs, really. And just writing the kind of stuff that he liked. And Nick Lowe was doing the same thing. And Nick Lowe's production style is very like, just, you know, just get it done. Just hurry up and get it done and record it very quickly. There's a film of them working Rockpile, which was his band with Dave Edmunds, working on, there was some contractual weirdness with that band, and so basically Dave Edmunds and Nick Lowe had to release albums separately as solo albums, but they were really Rockpile albums, and so whatever songs Dave Edmunds wrote would go on his album and Nick Lowe's songs, but it was really one album. It's very weird. But anyway, there's a film of them recording, I think it's Labor of Lust, and I can't remember Dave Edmunds' album, but he's just saying, no, let's, like, they were discussing it, and Nick Lowe's just, no, let's just go in and fucking nail it, let's just do it, let's just get it on tape. They were like discussing about, well, it should sound like this, and maybe we should EQ the drums. Like, no, just record it, just record it. So yeah, it was, He's very, not that he doesn't care what it sounds like, but it's just, the getting the perfect sonic quality of the drums is not the most important thing, you know? And it doesn't sound rushed, but it sounds, there is a rawness to it here. It's definitely not polished.
It's sort of immediacy to it, and that's kind of what sort of put it in the punk category, sort of, where, you know, the idea was just to kind of get it done and not slave over it so much and worry about it, much like, you know, they did with Dark Side of the Moon, where they really, really slaved over the sonic and, you know, with to tremendous results. But this is just a completely different approach. It's very definitely more of a live off the floor kind of thing, even if they're not recording live off the floor. I don't know if they're recording live off the floor. I think it was maybe pieced together a little bit.
Well, I think the basic tracks were recorded live, like the drums, bass drums and rhythm guitar, and then everything else was sort of added on after.
Yeah. But still, it's very much, they didn't slave over it the same way. They wanted to keep it a sort of, I don't know if the word is freshness or, maybe it is. I don't know. They're trying to keep it. They don't want to get sick of it before they're done putting it out or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah, no, and I think the critical reception at the time of it being released was overwhelmingly positive. I mean, this was not a huge hit, and like not a pop hit, but it was a pretty big album when it came out. So My Aim Is True received rave reviews from British and American music journalists on release. Writing for Trouser Press, Dave Schultz hailed My Aim Is True as 1977's most auspicious debut album, praising Costello's musicianship and songwriting, concluding he has produced a classic in his first try. It's pretty high praise. Chaz Diwali of Sounds called Costello a songwriter of rare sensitivity and talent, but had trouble getting a grip with the songs. Nevertheless, concluding, like a flower, Elvis's debut album is opening up into something of metallic beauty. So, like, it was a critical success. It wasn't a commercial success in the sense, like, it wasn't huge, but it had a pretty
respectable following.
A respectable following, exactly. There's footage of, after this album was released and before his second album was released, he was having some trouble sort of dealing with the sudden fame, even though it wasn't huge. And so the second album was sort of dealing with that, and the title of the second album is This Year's Model. There's a song on that album called Radio Radio, which is about more like simpler times in his life. And when he was on Saturday Night Live, he started playing, I think, the song Less Than Zero.
Yeah,
which is what the record company wanted him to play. And he stops the band and said, no. And he says, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I can't play this song right now. And he launches into Radio Radio. Yes. Yeah.
Pissed off a lot of people in the industry.
It pissed off a lot of people in the industry. It also pissed off, like, the people at Saturday Night Live, because they had done all the camera blocking to that other song, so they didn't really know where to put the cameras for the new song. It's that's just like a punk rock sort of move. That's just like,
yeah, it is.
You know, It's like, now, sorry, I can't.
The footage is still out there of him playing. And, you know, it. I'd say, you know, the, them just filming it turned out just fine. I mean, I always thought that the performance was a really good one.
It was, yeah. And there's a rumor that he was banned from Saturday Night Live after that, but that actually wasn't true, and I thought that was true for a long time. But he was never banned from Saturday. Actually, Lorne Michaels thought it was... He didn't think it was cool, but he did, like, he didn't care. Like,
it didn't bother him.
Didn't bother him. No, exactly. So yeah, so that's kind of who he was at the time. And there later in I think it's in 94, he did the same thing with the Beastie Boys, parodying the previous thing. I think it was the Beastie Boys were performing and he comes out and stops and it's like, no, there's no reason to play this song, and then does Radio with the Beastie Boys. It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I did manage to find a few facts about the album. So lending to the sound of it feeling very immediate and fresh, it was actually only, the whole album was only recorded in a few days. At the time of recording, Elvis Costello was still working a day job as a data entry clerk, so he had to squeeze in recording sessions during off hours. The entire album was tracked in just 6 sessions, each lasting about 4 hours, at Pathway Studios, a tiny 8-track studio in North London. The rushed and efficient process helped give the album its raw, energetic feel, as Costello and producer Nick Lowe aimed for immediacy rather than polished perfection. So one of the things is Elvis Costello's backing band was called The Attractions, but not on this album. He was backed by a band called Clover, and this is interesting, and I didn't know this. As many fans associate Costello with his longtime band, The Attractions, but they weren't part of My Aim Is True. Instead, the backing band was Clover, an American country rock group that had relocated to the UK in search of success. Interestingly, they didn't know Costello's name, Declan McManus, is his real name, at the time, and only met him in the studio. Clover members later found fame elsewhere. Keyboardist Sean Hopper and guitarist John McPhee went on to play with Huey Lewis and the News. Despite their contributions, Clover was uncredited on the album, partly due to Costello's label Stiff Records wanting to keep the focus on their new artist. I didn't know that basically the band was essentially Huey Lewis and the News, like, or two members of Huey Lewis and the News.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The cover's iconic pose was actually a mistake. So on the album cover featuring Costello standing pigeon-toed while holding a guitar and staring intensely into the camera became one of the most recognizable images of his career. However, his pose wasn't intentional. It was meant to be a simple test shot taken by the photographer, Keith Morris. But Costello's awkward, nervy stance perfectly matched his music's twitchy, rebellious energy. The record label loved it, and the image became an essential part of his early persona. The album cover also features a distinctive black and white checkered border reinforcing the punk new wave aesthetic of the era. And it is a pretty cool album cover.
Yeah.
It's very punk rock, but it's also like a throwback to the 50s.
Sort of rockabilly.
It is very cool. And so this is kind of cool too, is that there's a hidden message in the vinyl. So vinyl collectors love My Aim Is True, not just for its music, but for a little Easter egg in the original pressings. If you look closely at the runout groove, the space between the final track and the label on early UK pressings, you'll find an etched message. On side A, it says, "Elvis is King," referencing the real Elvis Presley, who was still alive when the album was released, though he passed away just a month later. Side B has Porky Prime Cut, a signature left by George Peckham, the mastering engineer who worked on many classic records, Peckham often added humorous or cryptic messages to his work, making these etchings a fun detail for fans and collectors.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to check my vinyl. I can't remember how old it is, but it's definitely not a new copy.
Yeah.
So
you might have that on the etching on the runout groove. So yeah. And the last one is the song Watching the Detectives. One of the album's most famous tracks, Watching the Detectives, wasn't actually recorded during the main My Aim Is True sessions. Costello wrote the song after a marathon listening session of The Clash's debut album. Drawing inspiration from its reggae punk energy, he recorded it later with a different backing band, including Steve Goulding and Andrew Bodner from Graham Parker and The Rumour. While it wasn't on the original UK release, Stiff Records added it to the US version to help boost sales. Recognizing its potential as a standout track, it became one of Costello's signature songs and helped introduce him to American audiences. Kind of interesting that it's one of those songs that...
we'll listen to it.
We'll listen to it, yeah. But it never...
It was never on the original album.
So anyway, those are some interesting facts that I found. Yeah, I guess we'll get back into the second side of the album. But before we do that, let's hear from our friends over at the Getting Down and Wordy podcast. So check those guys out.
Riz.
Greetings.
Gendered language.
Onomatopoeias.
The ick.
What makes some words sound funny?
Why just listen to music when you can overanalyze the words in the songs?
Music, language, and Eurovision all crammed into one podcast.
Getting Down and Wordy with Russell and Hannah. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
Okay, and ending the album with Watching the Detectives. Yeah, I don't really know what else to say. I mean, it's a fun, punchy rock and roll record. It's fun. The songs are great. The songwriting is great. Band's playing really well. You know, it's a great album overall. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm enjoying this one a lot. Yeah. I did notice that Watching the Detective definitely sounds like it was recorded in a different, session.
It for sure does.
The bass line, you know, it sounds great. I mean, both are great, but, you can definitely sort of tell the difference that it was sort of tacked on at the end. Still sounds like Elvis Costello stuff for sure, but the production is a little different.
it is a little different. It sounds a little. It doesn't sound as raw as the rest of the album.
No, it sounds. I think he probably had a similar approach to it, but again, he had completely different musicians in the room. So, and again, I don't think it was the attractions in that respect either. So
no, it was different people. Yeah. But you know, still a great song. This is one of my favorite eras of music, that late 70s new punk, new wave, whatever you want. I keep calling it new wave or punk. It's sort of the same attitude, I guess, you know.
Yeah, well, new wave was sort of supposed to be like punk's more approachable sibling.
Well, yeah, it was actually, do you know the story of how it was invented?
I think I heard it probably.
Well, it was actually Blondie's manager who they were, so Blondie was, they were a band that would play CBGBs in New York. To get on radio, like, they had the reputation of being a band from CBGBs, but they weren't like a hard punk band. But so their manager, in order to get their record played on radio, they said, well, it's not punk. It's this new thing called new wave. And so he basically just made it up on the spot, pitching to a radio station. It's like, oh, well, no, it's not. It's not that thing you think it is. It's this other thing. It's like he didn't even know what new wave was. He just came up with it. Like, so
it's a lot of times genres are invented exactly that way, by somebody pulling something out of their ass to try and, you know, put something somewhere where it otherwise wouldn't have been accepted or something like that. Like, even rock and roll was just sort of like, I think it was just named after I think it was a DJ just sort of called it that one day in 56.
Yeah. Alan Freed.
Yeah.
In Cleveland.
He just sort of coined the term. Other than that, it was basically just blues or rockabilly or something or whatever it was. It was rock and roll just was suddenly the name put upon this sort of new version of blues.
Well, rock and roll was a term that existed. It
basically meant sex.
It meant sex. But Alan Freed was the first one to describe music as rock and roll. Yeah. Which is, it was a slang term in the black communities for sex. Which is hilarious that, you know, that it became mainstream. It's everybody's, yeah, I love rock and roll. It's like, do you really know what you're saying? yeah. But anyway, I mean, getting back to this album, it is a throwback to sort of more like simple rock and roll, which we said before. This might be a difficult test, but what would be your three standout tracks on it?
Yeah, it was a little bit hard, because there's so many good ones. But I'm probably going to go for, I'll say Miracle Man, Waiting for the End of the World, because I love that song. Oh, and the third one is a little bit harder. I want to say maybe Blame It on Kane, but I might also say Mystery Dance. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out which one of those. Or I'm Not Angry. That's a good one.
Mine would probably be Waiting for the End of the World, Less Than Zero, and Blame It on Kane.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, those would be my picks. I mean, it's hard to pick. There isn't a bad song on the album. You know, I really don't think there is a weak song, which is pretty,
not really a weak spot.
Yeah. He just came out of the gate swinging with this one. So would you listen to this again?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No question. I mean, this is, yeah, I grew up listening to this album. You know, it wasn't on all the time, so I'm not super familiar with it, but I, you know, I'm familiar with it and enough to know that, say, yeah, this is a really good album. So, yeah, I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. Don't forget to subscribe so you know when new episodes are released. And we'd love it if you leave us a rating and a review, as it really helps new listeners find us. If you want to support the show and get some exclusive content, head over to Patreon. Go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. You can get these episodes the day before they go live. And you can also check out the website. Go to polyphonicpress.com and get all these all the previous episodes that we've done so far. And and I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.